In the 2022 Supreme Court case, Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania v. Casey, the court ruled that there is no constitutional right to abortion, reversing 50 years of protections extended by Roe v. Wade. Behind the headlines lie broader implications to that case that have to do with the way the Constitution is interpreted in other cases, including those involving gun ownership and public prayer. I'm Norman Gilliland. Join UW Professor Howard Schwaber and me as we look at some Supreme Court cases that may be bigger than you think. It's University of the Air, and it's next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey, the court was asked to overrule Roe v. Wade. After a searching examination, the court concluded that the essential holding of Roe should be reaffirmed. It further explained, in no uncertain terms, the woman's right to terminate her pregnancy before viability is the most central principle of Roe v. Wade. It is a rule of law and a component of liberty we cannot renounce. In 2022, the Supreme Court overturned its own case. In 2022, the Supreme Court reversed itself with that case of Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania v. Casey, ruling that there is no constitutional right to abortion. But beyond that, what do these rulings say, and what is their broader significance? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and also affiliated with the law school at the UW-Madison, and welcome back to University of the Air.
Well, thanks for having me.
Some of these cases still resonate today, after all. It's not that long since they were handed down in 2022. But just how radical are they, and what is the overall significance of some of these cases?
Well, that's really the fascinating thing. So the Dobbs decision in the summer of 2022, also the Bruin decision, which I'm also going to talk about having to do with the Second Amendment and guns, those are both very politically charged decisions. The decision on abortion played a significant role in the midterms. It'll be months before we finish parsing that data, but it's clear it played at least some significant role and certainly caused a great deal of shock and consternation. The thing that's most interesting is that the actual issues in the case, abortion on the one hand and guns on the other, are the least significant and also the least radical things about what the Roberts Court did. These are tremendously important turning points. It remains to be seen whether it often happens that the court announces a radical new direction in a case, and then the question becomes, will they follow down that road? Will there be later cases that continue that way, or will it be a one-off?
Is it a precedent, or is it
Well, it's always a precedent, but will they continue to build on that reasoning in other contexts?
Where were they coming from? Where were they coming from then, the court, in terms of their thinking for reversing?
Right. So to explain that, I have to dive back into history a little bit at the risk of boring some of your listeners. But I really think it's essential to understand what happened and why it's so important. So the first thing that people who aren't in this particular business often don't realize is that prior to the Civil War, we basically had no constitutional rights. None of the rights in the Bill of Rights applied against the states at all. States were perfectly free to put you in prison for criticizing the government. States were perfectly free to establish religions or lock you up without a trial or do any of the other things that we assume violate the rights guaranteed in the Constitution because the Bill of Rights did not apply against the states at all. It's not quite true that there were no rights. Article 1, Section 10 has a few very specific restrictions on what states may do. They may not impair contracts. They may not have titles of nobility, but it's very limited.
And not all that exciting today.
Well, the Contracts Clause still has some teeth, but the titles of nobility doesn't get nearly as much play as I think the framers thought it might at the time that they wrote it. The great sea change in American constitutionalism as far as rights are concerned is the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment was adopted as one of the Reconstruction Amendments after the Civil War. It was part, along with the 13th and the 15th Amendment, part of a program of very deliberately reshaping the Constitution in a way that would enable the national government to intervene in the South, in the post-Civil War South, and undo the slaveocracy society. It's a huge, complicated story. You could fill this room and then some with the books that were written trying to explain it. But the very short version is that once you get to about the 1920s, the shape of what's going to happen starts to become somewhat more clear. And the way it breaks down is this. The 14th Amendment is understood to protect rights in two distinct ways. First, some, and I emphasize some, not all, of the rights in the Bill of Rights will apply against the states. And that's, for example, the Free Speech Clause, which is everyone's favorite right. If you ask someone a quick name a right, almost always they're going to say free speech. It's also the very first one of the rights in the Bill of Rights that was applied against the states, a case called Gitlow versus New York in 1925.
So this is the federal government now saying we are controlling this.
This is the Supreme Court saying that states are bound to follow that provision of the Constitution. The role of the federal government then is to pass statutes to enforce that right. But it's the court that says there is this right and states have to abide by it.
It sounds like a good post-Civil War phenomenon.
Well, it does, doesn't it? But it took a generation because for a long time the Supreme Court after the Civil War was trying very hard not to recognize any rights because it was very pro-Southern. But that's, as I said, a very long and complicated story, although one that has resonances in modern cases even today. But so one part of the – so in 1925, the Free Speech Clause, for the very first time, the Supreme Court says, yes, states are bound by the Free Speech Clause. Other clauses of the Bill of Rights didn't apply to the states until much later. The religion clauses of the First Amendment didn't apply till the 1940s. So even – it's not just amendment by amendment. It's clause by clause that these rights were applied against the states. And as recently as 2 years ago, a piece of the Sixth Amendment was for the first time held to apply against the states, having to do with double jeopardy. At this point, almost all of them have been incorporated. States are not bound by the Seventh Amendment, and anyone who's listening who knows what the Seventh Amendment says should give themselves a cookie. It provides for jury trials in civil cases where the amount at issue is more than $20. The Supreme Court has not said that states have to provide those jury trials. So that's one set of rights, and those are the rights in the Bill of Rights that have been – the word is incorporated to apply against the states is one way the 14th Amendment created rights. The other way – happening in the very same time period and actually starting first. This actually goes back to the 1890s at least, although again not before the Civil War, is called substantive due process. And that name tends to make people's eyes cross and there's a long complicated story behind it which I desperately would rather not get into. But what it means is the other parts of the 14th Amendment, Section 1, has the three famous clauses, the Due Process Clause, the Equal Protection Clause, and the Privileges and Immunities Clause. And even if you've never heard the phrase 14th Amendment, you've probably heard the phrase equal protection and you've probably heard the phrase due process.
Absolutely.
And by the 1890s, there starts to be the idea that these clauses interpreted in certain ways – very messy, very complicated, but interpreted in certain ways, guarantee rights that states have to observe. Some of them are very obvious. Think of Brown versus Board of Education, one of the most famous cases of all time in 1954. That was the Supreme Court saying that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment means states may not have racially segregated schools. There's a really good, easy example of the court finding a right. You have a right not to be sent to racially segregated schools. In the 14th Amendment applying it to the states. So there were these two kinds of rights. And it's very interesting because even in the 1920s, those substantive due process rights got into some really interesting areas. For example, the Supreme Court held in a 1925 case – it is 25. I just had to check. In a 1925 case called Meyer versus Nebraska that parents have a constitutional right to send their children to German-speaking schools.
I can see where that could be – widened in its application.
Absolutely. The whole idea of rights of parents comes from that substantive due process notion. Later, the same year or the next year, there was a case that, said parents have a right to send their kids to private schools.
Charter schools.
Religious schools. Right. So all of the fights that we have nowadays about public education have as part of their background that some of the very earliest substantive due process rights that were recognized were the rights of parents to control the upbringing and education of their children. Within limits. All rights have limits. No rights are absolute. And so, of course, there are instances where the government may intervene. And there have been hundreds, I would have to say, federal court cases about what the government may or may not do to force you to have your children educated in a certain way. All right. Moving forward, once that model was in place, that some rights apply to the states because of incorporation, and those are rights that are in the Bill of Rights, and some rights apply to the states because of substantive due process, and those are sort of broad conceptual rights. Starting in the 1940s, the court began to become quite aggressive about finding expansive interpretations of these rights. And this eventually becomes the famous Warren Court in the late 50s and then through the 60s and the Berger Court in the 70s, but it starts much earlier than that. And both incorporated rights and substantive due process rights began to be more and more fully developed.
And this is on behalf or playing into the powers of the federal versus the state governments?
Not directly. Those are a separate set of questions. There is a connection. The connection is Clause 5 of the 14th Amendment, which says that the federal government, Congress, has the authority to make laws to protect rights guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. So every time the court recognized a right, that automatically gave the federal government the authority to make a law to force states to respect that right. So the answer is yes, but you need another piece to make that connection. But you're absolutely right that an expansion of national rights is an expansion of the powers of the federal government and vice versa. One of the big issues in the Roberts Court that we can't get into today but perhaps a different day is the way the Roberts Court has scaled back Congress's powers under the 14th Amendment, particularly in issues involving democracy and voting and things like that. But that process or practice of finding broadly defined rights continues right up to the 1990s. And there are various tests that emerge. And the basic idea that emerges is where a right is found to exist, whether it's an incorporated right or a substantive due process right, and therefore applies against the states, in order for a state to have a law that infringes on that right, they have to satisfy something called strict scrutiny. What it means is they have to have a really, really good reason. But the test is a little more specific than that. It's a means and ends test. They have to have a compelling government interest, and they have to be using the most narrowly tailored possible means. So you have to have a really, really good reason, and you have to be doing absolutely no more than is necessary to achieve some incredibly important purpose. And that two-part means-ends test was the basic vocabulary of rights discourse from about 1950 to about 1995 or 2000. I'm being sloppy with the dates, but one gets the idea. At least that long, actually until 2022. Dobbs did away with that entire way of reasoning and substituted an entire new way of thinking about where rights come from and how they are protected and how we know what they are.
Well, the composition of the court obviously changes over the course of years.
Now, it does.
Some of the justices, of course, are there for many years, but over the course of time, and you're talking about chunks of time, 30, 40-year blocks in some cases, these profiles of the court change.
It does. The profiles of the justices do change, and very particularly the three justices appointed by Donald Trump through an extraordinary quirk of history were all ideologically fairly extreme in a certain direction. Dobbs, in this way that I'm describing, reflects the culmination of something that starts in the 80s with the Reagan administration and the desire to bring conservative justices to the court and scale back rights protections and impose the idea of originalism and various other moves. In the 1988, for example, the Justice Department under Edwin Meese developed a series of guidelines for constitutional litigation that told DOJ lawyers to look for opportunities to challenge and seek the overturning of certain precedents. It was a long list of precedents that they wanted to get rid of. So there was an idea about it. And this is also the period of the creation of the Federalist Society. So the idea that there was a desire to dramatically and significantly change the pattern of American constitutionalism, that wasn't new. It's not until 2022, however, that it finally happens. Except that there's a glimmer, a hint, if you like, in 1997. That's where I want to go next.
And 1997, what kind of court are we looking at?
We're looking at certainly a conservative court. At the time, everyone is saying, oh, my goodness, this court has moved so far to the right. Look how much they're doing to roll back the rights guarantees. In the immortal words of Al Jolson, you ain't seen nothing yet. But we didn't know that at the time. The Chief Justice is Rehnquist, and Rehnquist is squarely on board with this project of reshaping rights jurisprudence in America. And he uses this case to do it or to announce sort of a new approach.
Is the court, though, isn't it in kind of a passive role? In other words, well, you mentioned they were – at least the Department of Justice, I think, was charged with actually looking for cases that would challenge these concepts. But the Supreme Court has to wait for the case to come to them, right?
Well, yes, but the Supreme Court doesn't take every case that comes to it, and they always have hundreds and hundreds to choose from. And it wasn't just the DOJ. Another thing that started that was new with the Reagan administration was ideological litmus tests for judges. filling the bench with federal judges who shared these convictions. That really hadn't been done before, which is why historically you had Republican presidents appointing justices who turned out to be very liberal and Democratic presidents appointing justices who turned out to be unexpectedly conservative. The whole idea of really scrutinizing a judge's ideology and making sure they're on board with the program, whatever your program happens to be, really starts in the 80s as part of this process. So in 97, we have a case called Glucksberg versus Washington. Some of your listeners might remember it, probably not by name, but the case involved a woman who asserted the constitutional right to a physician's assistance in committing suicide. There had already been a determination that there was a constitutional right to decide not to receive medical care. You have a right to just let yourself die naturally.
But to go that extra step and actually take active measures to end your life with something different.
And with assistance by a physician, no less, that was something different. And so Chief Justice Rehnquist wrote the opinion and said, no, there's no such right. This goes too far. And he could have just stopped there. But instead, he used that case to announce a new approach. And the new approach went like this. In order to find a substantive due process right, so this is one of the rights that's not listed in the Bill of Rights. It's one of those rights that's contained just in the 14th Amendment standing by itself. You have to show, the person asserting this right has to show, that it is, quote, deeply rooted in our historical tradition. And what that turned out to mean was there's a long historical tradition, not just of allowing this practice, but of recognizing it as a constitutional right. And when you apply that test, this is the second part of the Glucksberg reasoning, you have to apply it very specifically. So it's not, for example, you can't say, I assert the right to have a physician provide whatever medical services I choose, and that includes a right to assistance in committing suicide. No, no, said Rehnquist. You have to be able to demonstrate a long-standing historical tradition of a recognized constitutional right to have a physician's assistance in committing suicide.
It sounds like a high bar.
It's a very high bar, and obviously in that case, it didn't fly. What everybody realized at the time was that cases like Roe were therefore put at risk because it's very easy to show that there's a long-standing historical practice of permitting abortion in America, but it's very hard to show that there's a long-standing historical practice of treating abortion as a constitutionally protected right. And remember, of course, that the Roe Court and the Casey Court and other courts that have considered cases involving sex and contraception and intimacy and so on, they never focus on the right described so specifically. The actual line in Casey is that a woman's right of privacy is sufficiently broad to encompass – or sorry, the right of privacy is sufficiently broad to encompass a woman's choice of whether to beget a child. That's how Blackmun phrased it. So it was the broad right of privacy, and things like abortion and contraception were just specifics.
That sounds a little tenuous too, though.
In a different way. We could easily do a whole separate show debating the relative merits of one approach or the other. But certainly that was how things worked at that time. And so to insist that rights be described with such specificity was new and a bit radical and clearly indicated the possibility of lots of rights that have been recognized being no longer recognized. Well, the whole court didn't go along with that, and in particular Justice Kennedy didn't. And through the early 2000s and right up to Obergefell, the case recognizing same-sex marriage, he insisted on writing opinions that talked about rights in very, very broad terms and indeed and specifically pointing to that Glucksberg ruling I talked about saying, well, it doesn't apply here. And I'll actually read you a short passage to show how directly these guys were talking to each other and saying we don't buy this case, we buy this case. This is not a hidden dialogue. This is a very explicit engagement. So this is now Kennedy in 2015 talking about why there is a right to same-sex marriage. He's gone through a long discussion of how important it is to people's dignity and to people's lives and so on. And then he says, objecting that this does not reflect an appropriate framing of the issue, the respondents refer to Washington versus Glucksberg, that case that I mentioned, which called for a careful description of fundamental rights. They assert the petitioners do not seek the exercise right to marry, but rather a new and non-existent right to same-sex marriage. Now, that's really important, right? You can frame the right generally, the right to marry, or you can frame the right very, very specifically, the right to marry Robert Smith on June 25th in Madison, Wisconsin. And depending how specifically you frame the right, going back to what you said earlier, more or less is encompassed. And Kennedy rejected the idea that in the case of same-sex marriage, rights should be defined that specifically. He said, while that approach may have been appropriate for the asserted right there involved, physician-assisted suicide, it is inconsistent with the approach this court has used in discussing other fundamental rights, including marriage and intimacy. And he says, for example, Loving, which is Loving versus Virginia, did not ask about a right to interracial marriage. Right? Loving is a famous case in 1965 where the Supreme Court said states may not ban interracial marriage. The Supreme Court said because that's part of the right to marry, not the specific right to marry people of other races. So in the 2000s, there is this division between what we call judicial conservatives and judicial liberals. I phrase it that way because Kennedy doesn't fit either neatly into either camp, and also liberal and conservative don't mean exactly the same things in this context that they do in ordinary politics. But there was a very definite division in the court between the idea that we should frame rights very narrowly and only substantive due process rights very narrowly and only recognize them if they're deeply rooted in our history, and no, we should continue to recognize things like the right to privacy and other unenumerated but implied rights that are contained as a matter of substantive due process and that apply broadly to, as Kennedy put it in another case, Lawrence versus Texas, in our tradition, the state is not omnipresent in the home.
How did they make the distinction, though, between the Virginia case, which is a case of interracial marriage, and cases of same-sex marriage?
Well, they didn't. That's the thing. The Supreme Court said they're the same, that the right to marry encompasses both.
Okay.
Rehnquist and the people who are trying to prevent same-sex marriage from going forward argued that there may be a right to interracial marriage, but there's not a right to same-sex marriage, that the difference has to do with the fact that the 14th Amendment should be understood to prevent racial discrimination but not to prevent racial discrimination on the basis of sex.
Should be understood. That's where you have your leeway, though.
Well, you have your leeway. And if you were there, they were arguing from an historically originalist position. They said the 14th Amendment was adopted after the Civil War for the purpose of adjusting, so to speak, relations between whites and blacks in the South, and it should not be used for any other purpose.
Well, that originalism does have a lot of things to answer for, doesn't it?
Well, especially after Dobbs. So now we get to Dobbs, which I hope some of our listeners are still with us because I know that was all lead up, but I think you'll find it's very useful and important lead up to understand what comes next, because the Dobbs opinion is really, really radical. First of all, of course, it overrules Roe and Casey, and that got everyone's attention, and that was startling. And sure enough, it did so by citing that Glucksberg versus Washington language about defining rights specifically and not finding substantive due process rights unless they're deeply rooted in our history. And again, it's not just is there a deeply rooted toleration of the practice of abortion. Is there a deeply rooted tradition of treating abortion as a constitutionally protected right? And you then apply originalism to that question. And so you ask, in 1791, was there a tradition of understanding this as a constitutionally protected right? And the answer is, of course,
no,
because there were essentially no constitutionally protected rights in 1791. But even leaving that aside, the answer is still no. I mean, just one of the many interesting points in all this is that the 14th Amendment is adopted in 1868. Well, let me come back to that. That's actually in the Bruin case. So, but here are some other things that Alito says, which is why I say it goes beyond just bringing forward the Glucksberg rule and applying it. That is the case that he cites. But he also says things like, for example, our decisions have held that the Due Process Clause protects two categories of substantive rights. The first of rights consists of rights guaranteed by the first eight amendments. Those amendments originally applied only to the federal government. That's incorporation of the Bill of Rights. The second category comprises a select list of fundamental rights that are not mentioned anywhere in the Constitution. That's substantive due process rights. What's startling about this, I mean, on the one hand, it's a banal observation, but Alito is going to say that these two rights need to be treated differently. But depending on which kind of right you're talking about, the tests for whether they apply and what they mean are completely different. And that is brand new.
And that is where we get into this whole idea of so much interpretation.
Absolutely.
Led.
Absolutely.
So much interpretation left to the courts. And we're going to look further into that when we return shortly. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Howard Schwaber, and we're looking at recent Supreme Court rulings from 2022, which of course have roots going back much further. And most recently, we have been looking at Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization and the overturning of Roe v. Wade. But we'll be looking at some other cases as well that have much bigger implications than we may be aware of. And we got into this whole question of interpretation.
Right.
That is really a powerful tool for a Supreme Court justice.
It's tremendously powerful. And one way to capture the debate that we've been talking about is a debate between two different modes of interpretation, one of which is devoted to narrowly and specifically defined rights grounded in originalism, one of which is devoted to philosophically broadly broad understandings of rights tied to modern conceptions of what constitutes a free society. That's a simplification of both positions, but it does identify the huge division, conceptual division between approaches that's at work.
And gets us into some of these cases that are then reversed. Well, obviously Roe v. Wade being a major example of where the court changes direction.
Right. So we had gotten as far as observing that Roe was overturned because there is no deeply rooted tradition of treating the choice of abortion as a constitutionally protected right.
It's not explicitly protected in the Constitution.
Well, that's for sure. But no, it's more than that. Remember, we're talking about substantive due process rights here. So we're talking about rights that are not listed in the Bill of Rights. There's no historical long-standing, deeply rooted practice of thinking about abortion as a constitutionally protected right, which is a fair statement.
Yes.
Although it may all depend on what you mean by deeply rooted, but these guys mean 1791. They mean the original Constitution. And by the way, that's true even with respect to the 14th Amendment. They say that we should come back to that. That's mostly true when we're talking about incorporated rights. When we're talking about rights that are listed in the Bill of Rights, deeply rooted means 1791. When we're talking about rights that are substantive due process rights that only exist in the 14th Amendment and weren't part of the Bill of Rights before, then we're talking 1868.
When that amendment came in.
Came into force, exactly. So having found that, Alito could have just applied the Glucksberg test and stopped, but he made this new idea that there's two different kinds of rights. He could have stopped there, but he still wasn't done. He then went on to describe, said, because there's no right at stake, all we have are competing interests. The woman has one interest, the state has a different interest, and it's up to the states. It's a political matter to determine how those interests should be balanced. The obvious question to readers and listeners was, what other rights are now on the chopping block? What other rights that we've previously recognized, and the Supreme Court has previously recognized, are now at risk of being overturned because of this new approach? And Alito really talked out of both sides of his mouth on this topic. So on the one hand, there's a passage where it sounds like he very specifically says that Lawrence versus Texas and Obergefell versus Hodges in particular, the cases saying that it's unconstitutional to make homosexuality a crime and that it is there's a constitutional requirement that states recognize same-sex marriage. He seems to say both of those should be tossed. So let me set up though a little bit. First, he says abortion is a unique case and different from other rights claims.
Okay.
Citing a broad array of cases, the court in Roe found support for a constitutional right of personal privacy. But none of these decisions, and by these decisions he means those earlier cases going all the way back to the 1920s about parental rights to control children's upbringing, or cases from the 1960s about people's right to use contraception. So he means these other privacy-based decisions. None of these decisions involve what is distinct about abortion, its effect on what Roe termed potential life. So he starts by setting out a position that says abortion is a unique case because the specific issues are different. Fair. But of course, the fact that abortion uniquely involves what Roe terms potential life has nothing to do with the right question, with the rights question. It has to do with how you resolve that question. But whether there is a right or not can't possibly depend on the nature of what's at stake in the conduct. That can't be what defines whether or not it's part of the right. At least that's how it seemed to most observers. But he then goes on and seems to make a distinction. Now, in that last quotation I just read you, he said he referred specifically to cases that the Roe court relied on, meaning he's not talking about cases that came later.
Of course.
And when he says that, he talks about cases like Lawrence versus Texas, the right to engage in private consensual sexual acts, and Obergefell versus Hodges, the right to marry a person of the same sex. And he says he goes back to that specificity point. From Glucksberg, that says you have to define the right specifically. He says if you try to say that Lawrence and Obergefell are part of a general right to privacy rather than being specifically protected rights, remember in the same way that we said you could distinguish a right to interracial marriage, which might be different from a right to same-sex marriage.
Yes.
Alito says if you try to make this a more general Kennedy-style form of reasoning, saying this is just part of liberty, here's what happens. Quote, these arguments prove too much. Those criteria at a high level of generality could license fundamental rights to illicit drug use, prostitution, and the like. And the and this is really interesting. The case he's quoting there, and the case he's quoting is the dissenting opinion from the circuit court decision in Glucksberg. In other words, it's the kind of reference only a lawyer would notice. But sure. He's deliberately pointing people back to Glucksberg, not even the Supreme Court decision in Glucksberg, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case, and a dissenting judge who said this is all wrong, there mustn't be a right like this, and saying that's the path we should have been following all along.
With that one dissenting judge.
With that one dissenting judge. Well, and then Rehnquist's majority opinion for the Supreme Court as well. But it's a really clear signal that this is the path that I, Justice Alito, and the majority of the court think we should have been following all along. And if that's true, then Lawrence and Obergefell are probably not good law. And in fact, he ends the paragraph by saying, and I'm quoting, none of these rights has any claim to being deeply rooted in history. If these rights don't have a claim to being deeply rooted in history, then according to Dobbs, they are not constitutionally protected rights. That's the holding.
He's saying they shouldn't have been recognized in the first place,
well,
or whatever previous rulings.
Well, certainly sounds that way.
Mm-hmm.
But then he turns around and repeats the abortion's unique case position. None of the other decisions cited by Roe and Casey, again, looking backwards historically, not forward, involve the critical moral questions posed by abortion. They are therefore inapposite. So if you read Alito's majority opinion, lots of people came away with a notion, and I think this is correct, that by the logic of opinion, it's not just the right to abortion that's been overruled. The logic underlying privacy rights in general has been called into question, especially those involving LGBTQ plus individuals.
Are we seeing cases yet?
Now, this was only 2022,
sure.
This past summer.
Right.
Sure,
things can happen quickly when there's a lot at stake.
Cases are percolating. I'm not aware of any case the Supreme Court has agreed to hear. But again, remember, they only have to hear cases they want to.
Of course.
So
sure.
it's the rule of certiorari takes 4 votes. They may very well not want to have this case right away. What it really is an invitation to lawyers everywhere. If you've ever thought about challenging Obergefell or you've ever thought about challenging Lawrence, here's how to do it. Bring us a, it reads to a lawyer like, bring us a good case and we'll do, and I'll do this. I, Justice Alito, will do this. If you can bring me a good case, go find me one. Now, it takes time. It takes a couple of years to get through the federal court system. So there may very well be cases percolating in the lower courts. But there's no – I don't think there's any question that if you are predisposed in the first place to want to seek an overturning of Obergefell, of Lawrence, and possibly of other cases going back further – you know, if you're inclined to think that substantive due process rights and privacy rights have gone too far, that statement, none of these rights is deeply rooted in our history, tells you exactly how to make the argument. And this is now Supreme Court doctrine. There were other opinions in the case, though, which make it almost more interesting. Thomas concurs, and Thomas says exactly what everyone was thinking. Justice Clarence Thomas. We should overrule all the privacy cases, including the ones that Roe relied on. The ones previously like Griswold and Bowers and Obergefell. We should go all the way back and get rid of all of them. So that's 2 votes at least for getting rid of Lawrence and Obergefell and 1 vote for getting rid of all privacy rights cases, rules in general.
Would he have had any inkling of how far they would go with that at the time that they were confirmed?
No. In fact, this is one of the points that has rankled a lot of people. I don't want to use words like dissembled or lied. But each of these justices during confirmation stated repeatedly and clearly Roe is settled law of the land, and insisted they believed strongly in the principle of stare decisis, which is the principle that you shouldn't overturn an important precedent without a really good reason. Most famously, Senator Susan Collins of Maine insists that she was assured by Kavanaugh that he would never vote to overturn Roe. It is difficult, let us say, to avoid the impression that some of these people committed perjury. I would just leave it at that.
Wow.
I said difficult
Another
to avoid.
Another constitutional crisis.
I did not for a moment say I'm sure they did that. I just said it's difficult to avoid that impression.
Yes.
Yeah, on the other hand, you know, that's become a practice. Clarence Thomas, when he was confirmed, insisted he had never thought about the question of a constitutional right to abortion.
No matter who says it.
Right. But someone who's been to law school and then been a judge and is now being nominated for the U.S. Supreme Court and who is highly political in his views and is involved in conservative politics, it a little bit beggars the imagination to believe he's never thought – not never written, published. He claimed he had never thought seriously about the question of a right to abortion and therefore had no opinion on the question. And I have to say I don't think he was telling the truth.
Should have been room for more cross-examination.
Well, that's a whole different issue. So – And then Kavanaugh writes a concurring opinion insisting that this case does not imply overruling any of those earlier precedents. So he doesn't really explain why. He just says, we didn't say that, so it isn't true. Who knows where that will go? But that was actually only one of two cases. So remember, at the beginning of talking about Dobbs, I said that the first things that Alito did that was radical was to suggest that incorporated rights, those contained in the Bill of Rights, are completely different from rights that rely on substantive due process or the Equal Protection Clause, rights that exist only in the 14th Amendment.
Which sounds from a layman's standpoint like a rather arcane distinction.
You might very well think so, particularly since there had been 80 years of treating them as the same, with the same kind of analysis and the same means, ends, tests, and everything else. Well, Dobbs was a case that told us we had to reconsider how we think about rights in the 14th Amendment. They have to be deeply rooted in our history. It has to be a long tradition to recognize them as rights, all the stuff that we've just gone through. That same week, Bruin versus New York Pistol and Rifle Club came down about the Second Amendment. And that one told us we had to reshape everything we think about how to reason with respect to rights that are contained in the Bill of Rights. This one's by Thomas. And I can give it to you in one sentence, although wrapping one's head around the implications of the sentence is easier said than done. Go back to where Dobbs says we will only recognize 14th Amendment rights that are deeply rooted in our nation's history. Thomas says we will only in the context of rights in the Bill of Rights, we will only allow regulations where that regulation is deeply rooted in our nation's history.
Regulation, that covers a lot of territory.
The law, any law. So, for example, Dobbs asked whether there's a constitutional right to abortion. If we had applied the Bruin approach, we would have said, is there a longstanding historical tradition of having laws against abortion?
Right.
And that might have yielded the opposite answer.
Right.
So, I mean, this is a difference. This is not a distinction without a difference. This makes all the difference. Essentially, the burden of proof is, if you want to put it that way, is reversed. So this is the place where we get to that year 1791. Because Thomas says even though the Bill of Rights wasn't incorporated to apply to the states until the 14th Amendment and really the 1920s and really the 1940s and 60s, depending what right you're talking about, even though that's all true, we've said in the past – you have to follow this logic closely because it's a doozy – we've said in the past that the states are held to the same standards as the federal government once these rights are applied to them.
Right.
Therefore, the meaning of those rights is what they were in 1791 when they only applied to the federal government.
That's a
I warned you to watch the step. You can trip on that one very easily.
Yeah.
So now we have – I mean a really remarkably differentiated – I'm looking for a better word and I can't really come up with one way of treating these two categories of rights. If we're talking about 14th Amendment rights, we're looking at 1868 and we're asking is there a longstanding historical tradition going back to 1868 – or before, of recognize the right. If we're talking about rights in the Bill of Rights, like the Second Amendment, we're asking, are gun laws of this type something that was around in 1791?
With that argument, couldn't you take any amendment, the right for women to vote, and say we're just looking at – I mean
– you would say that
the date that the amendment comes in affects the interpretation of
– that's what originalism is all about. Except that Thomas goes further because he says in Bruin, actually, the right to bear arms doesn't come from the Second Amendment. It comes from our English historical heritage.
Right.
The
okay.
Second Amendment
– protect your home kind of
– Well, so the second right. – well, but this gets to be very, very slippery. The Second Amendment doesn't create the right. It only codifies it. So to understand what longstanding historical tradition of regulation means, we have to go to 17th century England. If there weren't laws governing guns of the type that are at issue in the case in place in 18th and 17th century England, then those laws are unconstitutional because the Second Amendment means that the – and now we can fill in the pieces here – that the 1791 understanding of the then longstanding historical tradition of rights and regulation governs what states may do under the Second Amendment. So I will give you an example. This is a real case that's come out down in the last couple of months. A court in West Virginia ruled that a law making it a crime to file serial numbers off of guns is unconstitutional because there was nothing like a law preventing filing serial numbers off of guns in 1791 or in English common law in the early 1700s.
You could argue that originalism is a phenomenal trap.
I think it's I mean this gets us into a long discussion. I think it's a pathology, frankly, but that's a whole different discussion. And intellectually dishonest, but that's a much bigger – I mean, I'd love to do a show on that, but it needs a whole show, because certainly lots of very intelligent, very decent people believe in originalism. Lots of very intelligent, very decent people think, as I do, that it's a terrible thing. The arguments on both sides are complicated. But here is – I think everyone agrees that this version of originalism, the version we're seeing in Bruin, is something we have not seen before. In any court case, and really not much even in conversation, it's extreme. There's more to it. Let me read you, though, just the one quotation. I've been saying this is the rule of the case. I always am afraid people will think I'm making things up, especially my students. I'm always afraid they're going to say, you're making it up. So here it is. To justify its regulation, the government must demonstrate that the regulation is consistent with the nation's historic traditions of firearm regulation. Only if a firearm regulation is consistent with this nation's historical tradition may a court conclude that the individual's conduct falls outside the Second Amendment's unqualified command. Let's give it another – a different analogy for this. There are a lot of folks who are very rightly, in my view, concerned about how to apply the First Amendment in cyberspace.
Sure, of course.
Right, there are all kinds of issues.
Sure, lots of problems.
And there have been various – California, among I think 7 other states, have now laws against what's called revenge porn. There was a case in Minnesota that upheld a conviction, a lawsuit for damages for engaging in doxing, swarming, and other sort of unpleasant online tactics. Up until now, as far as I know, Bruin has only been cited in the context of gun cases in the Second Amendment. But that's not what it says. It says any right that's listed in the Bill of Rights is to be treated in this way. So you would have to ask, is there a historical tradition going back before 1791 to English common law practice of something that looks like regulating the internet in the way that you want to regulate it?
Exactly.
And the answer is almost surely going to be no. It is going to be very, very difficult to draw an analogy to hand-printed broadsheets being read aloud in the town square, or whatever the analogy is going to have to be.
Very little revenge
at
porn
that point.
And broad
as far as we know. An even better example might be sexual harassment. So sexual harassment, particularly what's called laws against hostile environment sexual harassment, are often challenged on First Amendment grounds, that they restrict expression too much. As I read it, and I don't see another way to read it, the logic of Bruin says this is a First Amendment issue. Therefore, we have to ask – so it's a right in the Bill of Rights, not one of those 14th Amendment rights. Therefore, we don't ask, is there a long-standing tradition of seeing a right against sexual harassment? We ask, is there a long-standing tradition of laws preventing and criminalizing sexual harassment? And none of our listeners will be shocked to learn the answer is no. There is not such a long-standing historical tradition.
Not in 1791.
Not in 1791. That's right.
And we will have a few fleeting, I'm afraid, further thoughts about these Supreme Court decisions that may be a lot bigger than we think. This is University of the Year. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Howard Schwaber, and we're looking at Supreme Court cases that may be a lot bigger than we think, recent ones from the year 2022. And we've gotten into this case, the Bruin case, in which Clarence Thomas, among other justices, made certain statements about the Second Amendment rights based on the concept of originalism, what was intended by the framers of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights in 1791. And does that apply? Does it spill over into other cases, other situations?
Well, it does, but I have to correct you slightly because there are lots of different versions of originalism. This one is not based on what the founders intended or founders understood. This one is based on what was the practice at the time. Were there laws against were there regulations about the use of guns similar to the ones at issue? So the actual case in New York, in Bruin, involved New York City, which has a system of permitting for concealed carry, and says that if you qualify for concealed carry, that is, if you check all the boxes with the necessary qualifications, you nonetheless might not get one if the regulatory commission decides not to give you one. And so the specific question was, is there a 1791 and earlier – remember that whole English common law codified right, not creating a right thing – tradition of barring people from carrying weapons in public places in general? And the answer was no. And that's why New York law was struck down. But Thomas did leave some room for adjustments to new circumstances. And here's how he put it. So, for example, one new circumstance is weapons. There are obviously different kinds of guns now than there were then. And there are people who say, oh, if you're really originalist, you should only allow people to carry flintlocks.
I've heard that.
Right. No, says Thomas, you know, changes in technology is one of the changes we adapt to. Although for him, that means therefore we allow, say, automatic weapons. Now, it may also mean therefore we can still ban bazookas, flamethrowers, fully automatic machine guns. We don't know yet. I mean, it may mean that his singling out types of weapon as something that changes with history in terms of its meaning, you know, might be significant. And in fact, if you study the history of the Second Amendment, there's a long-standing tradition of saying there had been prior to 2008, the Heller decision, a long-standing tradition saying that it was limited to the kind of weapons usually used for military service. So the whole issue of what kind of weapons are involved is still an open question. The second thing – oh, sorry.
I was going to say I can imagine all kinds of fine lines being drawn.
Well, sure. Think about bump stocks. Bump stocks and other things to other devices to make a single fire weapon into an effectively an automatic weapon or effectively a semi-automatic weapon. It's an accelerated semi-automatic weapon. I'm not sure what the word is for that. You know, those devices were unknown in 1791, as were regulations prohibiting their use. I don't know where that leaves us. I don't know where laws about silencers go, for example. I don't know where laws – if there were laws, you know, limiting what used to be called cop killer bullets, Teflon bullets that go right through body armor. There's all kinds of these questions. And it's just not at all clear from the Bruin opinion. What is clear from the Bruin opinion is that to answer these questions, we have to ask, is there some analogous regulatory practice prior to 1791 that we can point to?
Looks very leaky to me.
It's extremely leaky. I've already mentioned that in West Virginia, a federal judge has ruled that you can't stop people from filing serial numbers off of weapons, which I would have thought is a ruling that would have the law enforcement community losing its mind. But I have not heard a lot of public response thus far. The other thing that Thomas said, which is also interesting, is that, for example, he says there is a longstanding pre-1791 tradition of rules banning firearms in sensitive places. And he identifies legislative assemblies, polling places, and courthouses, thus alluding to the fact that, as has often been noted, that guns aren't allowed in the Supreme Court. Yes, says Thomas, that's perfectly traditional. But again, he turns it into a very strange and interesting argument that goes like this. There's an original practice of regulation not allowing guns in sensitive places. Got it. There is also, he says, quote, we are also aware of no disputes regarding the lawfulness of such prohibitions. So there's a longstanding practice and it was non-controversial, which is another wrinkle.
Yes.
So if it had been controversial in 1791, then maybe we still wouldn't allow that kind of regulation. But if from the 16th century up to 1791, I keep saying that because it just feels so utterly unexpected, there has been a long-standing tradition of regulating the carrying of weapons in sensitive places, then we might be willing to uphold modern regulations regulating the carrying of weapons in sensitive places, even if they're different sensitive places, like hospitals, for example. There were no hospitals in 1791. Now there are. But we could reason by analogy to say, well, they're like courthouses, polling places, and legislative assemblies. The problem with this reasoning is Thomas's observation that these things were not considered – These forms of regulation were not considered controversial as a matter of constitutional rights. There were no constitutional rights. The Bill of Rights didn't apply to the states until the 1920s. The most you could say is it was not controversial for the federal government to ban carrying guns in federal courthouses, which tells you absolutely nothing, I think. I suppose we could have this argument. If that's the entirety of the basis for the originalist claim, I submit that it's a thin one.
Yes, I would say that again could get you into a lot of cases that would be problematic.
Mm-hmm. But just to finish up, here's the sort of closing statement. And I said earlier that you can think about Dobbs and Bruin as different in terms of burden shifting. Who has the burden to show what is historically rooted and what isn't? Here's Thomas using that very same language. The burden falls on respondents to show that New York's proper cause requirement, that is, you only get a concealed carry permit to carry a gun in public – concealed, if you have a proper cause for doing so, is consistent with the nation's historical traditions of firearm regulation. Only if respondents carry that burden can they show that the pre-existing right codified in the Second Amendment and made applicable to the states through the 14th, does not protect petitioners' proposed course of conduct. And as I've tried to suggest, thus far we've only seen that applied to guns because that's what Bruin was about. But as a statement of principle about codified rights contained in the Bill of Rights, it goes much, much further than that. And we, in fact, already have a case from that same summer of 2022.
And which sort of case would that be?
This had to do with religious prayers at football after football game, high school football games. It's City of Bremerton, Kennedy versus City of Bremerton.
Sure.
And it's an interesting case in its own, and I know I keep saying this, but we could do a whole show on that topic because it's a huge and important topic. But what is interesting is that in that case, the majority of the court took the position that I'm quoting, the line that courts and government must draw between the permissible and the impermissible, this is now under the Establishment Clause, has to accord with history and faithfully reflect the understanding of the Founding Fathers. That is, we're asking, is this the kind of regulation that was commonly in place in 1791? It's effectively the same test as Bruin.
Yes,
being applied
in a First
Amendment context, very, very different context, with respect to the Establishment Clause. And again, I think it should shock no one to learn that in 1791 in America, and particularly in 17th century England, protections against religious establishment were a whole lot less stringent than those that we become accustomed to in the 20th century.
Otherwise, a lot of people wouldn't be here.
Otherwise, a lot of people would not, in fact, be here. That is correct.
This whole question, though, of originalism exactly, but
I call it original practice originalism. It's a very particular form
of these precedents in terms of practice seems to be problematic, though, because slavery was a practice. I mean, all kinds of things that we would not approve of today have been practiced.
Sure, but of course slavery is banned by the 13th Amendment. And so but the way that question would arise, however, is following the 13th Amendment, what kind of regulatory practices were permitted? Jim Crow laws, for example. And you would therefore say Jim Crow laws do not violate the 13th Amendment, which is correct. They were struck down as violating the Equal Protection Clause. But yes, this, and by the way, you're pointing at that the issue of slavery is not at all off point and it's not at all coincidental. I said at the outset that after the Civil War and the adoption of the 14th Amendment, there was a historical period when the court tried to prevent the 14th Amendment from protecting very many rights. The Roberts Court today is revitalizing arguments and theories from that period to limit not so much rights but something you mentioned earlier, Congress's power to pass legislation to protect rights. That's exactly where we see them going back to that period and narrowing Congress's power to pass laws to protect 14th Amendment rights on the theory that this is consistent with what was the original practice at the time of the adoption of the amendment.
Which fundamentally to me again seems like a flawed argument because the whole point of passing laws is to get away often from standard practice.
One would think, I mean, as I say, this really does deserve a whole discussion of its own. Heaven knows I've devoted many lectures to it. One view says, you know, if people didn't want to do bad things, there wouldn't need to be laws against them. So the whole point of laws is to say how we should behave in ways better than we might want to. And the whole point of new laws is to say how people should behave in ways better than we realized when we passed the old laws. And the whole idea of making law in the first place is to govern society in accordance with norms that we consider to be fundamental and shared. And the same should be true of the Constitution. The alternative argument is no. The Constitution is solely preservative. It exists only in late Justice Scalia's words to prevent backsliding from the historical point we started at in either 1868 or 1791. That doesn't mean you can't have other kinds of laws to make society a better place. But the constitutional question, constitutional rights only exist up to that point in history. Well, now with Bruin, we've gone one step further. You can't have laws that would, for example, limit guns, no matter how much you might think that will make society a better place, if you didn't have laws of that kind in 1791. And I think you're exactly right. I think this is taking originalism to the point where it no longer is a theory based on treating the Constitution as very different from ordinary law, and rather makes it a theory that limits ordinary law as it limits the Constitution as well.
And we'll leave it with that large thought this time around. There may be a another time around where we could get into some of these other issues in greater detail. I would look forward to that. Howard Schwaber.
Thank you so much.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around. Our engineer is Tom Blaine, and this is University of the Air.